You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program, and here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Welcome, everybody, to tonight's live broadcast of TPC. We have turned another page on the calendar as we are blitzing through 2024. It is Saturday night, April the 6th now, and we are moving forward. This is a transition broadcast as we transition from one special series, March Around the World, to our next special series, and that's a transition we'll make in the next hour and then going forward through the rest of this month with our showcase of the South, as we always do. But I wanted to put, I think, an exclamation point on the March Around the World coverage, which so heavily featured conversations with different people and about different people pertaining to so-called hate crimes. And just last week, we had Dries Van Langenhove, a former member of the Belgian parliament, on the program. He's facing a year in prison for not reprimanding someone who sent an offensive meme. That is the absolute state of free speech in Europe right now. And to help me close out that March Around the World series, even here in this first hour of the first show in April, is a man who is making his debut appearance on this program, though I have known about his work for over two decades. What is the current state of free speech and thought and association in Europe? What are its prospects for the future? We're going to find out the opinion of a man who has truly paid the price for being a dissident thinker, and that is Germar Rudolph, a German chemist by education and an author who has been sentenced to prison for years for his beliefs, and he's with us now. Germar, it is great to have you on the show tonight. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Just a little bit of background about our guest. Germar Rudolph was born on October 29th, 1964, in Limburg, Germany. He studied chemistry at Bonn University, where he graduated with a degree that's comparable to a U.S. PhD. From 1990 to 1993, he prepared a German PhD thesis at the Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in conjunction with the University of Stuttgart. In Germany, and that is a little bit just a very, very, very short thumbnail on your educational background, but that is not why you are known around the world. Tell us a little bit more about that, and there's so much I want to get into with you tonight, Germar.
Yeah, I kind of prepared two PhD theses at the same time, the official one and the unofficial one. During my student years, I got interested in history, and I was following contemporary history books very closely, just as a hobby. And I stumbled over a research that had been done in 1988 by an American expert for execution technology. That's kind of a unique profession that kind of exists only in the United States, because where there's death penalty, they need to be experts on how to kill people officially. And that guy actually got asked to by a Canadian, German-Canadian, who was on trial in Canada. He was asked to go to Auschwitz and Majdanek, the former German camps in what is now Poland, and to verify whether the facilities there are actually capable of mass murdering people, as the mainstream narrative goes. He did that. He came back with technical and chemical arguments saying it was not possible, as claimed. That caused quite an uproar. A year later, I learned about it through a book that was written on controversial historical topic in Germany. And of course, the whole topic of mass murder during the Third Reich in so-called extermination camps is a German issue, a part of German history. And I ran into it. I was at that point just wrapping up my diploma degree, my master's. It's kind of in between a master's degree and a PhD in Germany, and I got interested because it had a chemical spin to it. The weapon that says to have been used, Cyclone B, is basically hydrogen cyanide, and this reacts with rust in wall material and forms a long-term stable compound. And I was asked then by defense lawyers whether I could prepare an expert report for clients that were on trial in Germany for quote unquote Holocaust denial, verify or to check on that American expert's report whether it is valid or not, and whether it can be replicated or bolstered or refuted or whatever the case may be. So that I agreed to do that while I was officially working on my PhD thesis. So I was doing both these research projects parallelly. And it was like a PhD thesis and an anti-PhD thesis. And when you put matter and antimatter together, it gives a big explosion and everything gets annihilated. And that's kind of what happened. Because at the time when I was about to wrap up my official PhD, this work that I was doing was presented in courts, became publicly known, and caused a big uproar, furor, and a scandal. And they threw me out and denied me the final PhD exam. And the courts denied me to testify and were threatening me and eventually prosecuting me, throwing me into prison for that research. And for further ongoing research, kept prosecuting me, and I eventually left the country.
All right.
That gave me, unfortunately, some expert knowledge by experience on censorship and persecution in Germany in particular. Then I went through several European countries and had to realize they are tightening the thumbscrews there as well. Ended up making this topic of monitoring free speech and giving a platform to dissidents who can't find a public voice anymore in Europe, giving them a platform, made that my profession, and as such have been monitoring and dealing with European censorship, but expanding worldwide for the past 3 decades, I would say.
All right, let's pause right there. So you know why Grandma Rudolph is on the program right now, ladies and gentlemen. He used his background in chemistry to tackle a question that you're not supposed to question. And the purpose of this conversation tonight is to not prove or disprove whatever happened during the World War II years in Germany. It is about free speech. Now, we all have our personal opinions on what might have happened or not happened and to what extent. And we're going to get into that a little bit, but that is not the purpose of this conversation. However, before we move on to the broader topic of free speech, you got to ask yourself, why are people going to prison in Europe now for not reprimanding others who say something that's supposedly offensive? Is Sam Melia in prison right now in the UK for distributing stickers that say it's okay to be white? Where did all of this start? And I think, certainly Grandma Rudolph is, exhibit A or, one of these prime exhibits, I think, in where it started and the slippery slope that we have been descending down ever since. GermarRudolph.com is the website. GermarRudolph, GermarRudolph.com. There, one of his newer books is Resistance is Obligatory, with a nice photo of Galileo on the cover, quite appropriately. And I'm going to read a little bit from the cover of this book, or the endorsement of this book, I should say. The story goes that when Galileo faced his inquisitors, they showed him the instruments of torture. Whatever else he may have been, Galileo was also a physician, so he knew what metal does to flesh. Hence, he recanted. Not so Grandma Rudolph. It is also said that in his recantation, Galileo crawled across the floor to his accusers. Not so Grandma Rudolph. In a letter written by Germar from his prison cell, he examines why he became a revisionist and why he was prepared to pay such a terrible price. The fact is that Germar was never much interested in World War II or the Holocaust. What interested him were the whys and the wherefores of the propaganda. Why was it created? How is it propagated, maintained, and enforced? And why do we believe in them? And to him, the propaganda wasn't just mere historical issue, but also an ideological issue. Nor does it seem to be any single motive for his interest. Rather, it stems from a mixture of personal history and personality. From childhood, Germar was blessed or cursed with an insane curiosity for what he describes as a greatly overdeveloped sense of justice. So, needless to say, your findings ran contrary to the official narrative of those years. And in this book that we just mentioned, Resistance is Obligatory, you have published an address that you made to the Mannheim District Court prior to your sentence and conviction. And I've just got to ask you. I mean, what was it like, if you don't mind me asking? I mean, this is very personal, but what was it like to go to prison for engaging in freedom of thought? Right or wrong, to go to prison, and when you were in prison, did you feel as though, wow, you know what? Actually, being in prison, it leads me to believe, and now I know for sure that obviously they are right about all of these things. Did you ever revisit your findings? Or obviously, you know, I know the answer to that. It's hypothetical, but I mean, are you supposed to, is the lesson that you're supposed to learn in prison that you were wrong, or just that you're supposed to shut up?
Nobody discusses with you whether you're wrong or not. We had even one judge that was staging a trial parallel to mine back then in 2007 say, it doesn't matter whether the Holocaust happened or not. What matters is that you're not allowed to deny it. That's the situation. In Germany, under current law, it is forbidden for you to try to prove in court that you were right with your thesis, because then you were committing the crime, very crime that you were in court for, right in the courtroom again. So the issues themselves are never discussed. It is actually illegal. And if a defense lawyer tries to discuss things in the courtroom, he can be muzzled and he gets just silenced. And if he speaks out anyhow, he gets carried out of the courtroom and gets thrown in prison. So everything has to be done in writing, and nothing is allowed to be challenged. That's the situation in Germany, and it is the most repressive kind of justice, or lack of justice, I should say, procedural rules that you have in the world when it comes to defense, being able to defend itself in these cases. You're basically completely paralyzed. The only thing that you can do in a German court, there's this particular provision that they haven't removed yet. A defendant is permitted without restriction to make statements about the case. So they can't muzzle the defendant. He can stand up and give a lecture. That's what I've done. What you read there, the book is 300 pages. It's, I think 200 of them is actually a transcript of the lectures that I held in that courtroom, talking not about my historical or scientific findings, but talking about legal principles of civil rights, the right to resist, the duty to resist. That's where the book's title comes from. It's actually enshrined in the German Constitution after lessons we've learned in the Hitler era, that a government that turns dictatorial, tyrannical, every citizen has the obligation to resist and the right to resist. It's Article 20, paragraph 4 of the German Constitution gives every German citizen the right to resist. And we learn in school in Germany, we have the duty to resist when government authorities cross the red line of violating civil rights. And doubting your senses, doubting the appearance of what seems to be true, and systematically investigating whether your sensory input is correct or not, and then communicating what you have found to the world. This is the one thing that sets humans apart from other creatures on this planet. Everything else that we can do, pretty much we can find animals that can do that too. But doubting our senses, systematically looking for the truth, and then communicating to others what we have found, that is the core of humanity. And when a state starts suppressing that process, that very process of our humanity, the state crosses the red line. And the more the state became repressive against me, the Germans say, well, it was not the only. I mean, I got deported from the United States where I sought political asylum. It was rejected, and I was thrown back to Germany, and they put me on trial there again and sentenced me again. That infuriates me and stiffened my resistance. It did not break my will. It did not soften me up. It didn't convince me of anything. If you have no arguments, or you don't use intellectual arguments against a scholar, against an academic, but use pure force and violence, which basically that's what it is. The police come with guns and threaten you if you don't submit yourself to whatever they want to do to you. It gets really nasty. So you have to submit. But this is pure violence. And State violence against academic peaceful dissent is exactly the point where resistance is obligatory.
That's what we're here to talk about. And folks, we're skipping the breaks this hour so we can maximize our time with Gurmar Rudolph. I think it's that important of a guest and that important of our conversation. So we're talking a little bit about his background, both as a trained chemist and, of course, the conclusions that he found that got him in prison and what that experience was like. And we're going to move from this in the second half of this hour to his wider thoughts on what's going on in Europe writ large and in some of these other cases. I mean, news even since last week, the new so-called hate crimes law in Scotland. We'll touch on all of that with a guy who has been there, all right, 44 months in prison. That was his sentence for questioning the official narrative of the World War II years in Germany. I've got two questions for you, Gurmar, if we could work them in quickly before the bottom of the hour break, which we do have to take. We're skipping the floater breaks at 15 and 45. Have to take the bottom of the hour break. So we've got about 6 or 7 minutes to hit two questions here, and I want to do that before the break. And the first one is this. The same people who deride the Salem witch trials, you know, certainly cheer on the harsh imprisonment of dissidents who question certain historical events when they get to be the judges, all right? Is there a bit of contradiction in ideology there?
The parallel to you mentioned witch trials is actually a good one because I've made my own analysis. I wrote an article about this. When people think about witch trials, they primarily think about torture and cruelty. But if you look into the history of it, torture and forced confessions was only a small part. There is a lot of parallel things. Like I mentioned, I'm not allowed to doubt the state dogma, and if I do, there's a speech from the Middle Ages from the legislature that says "Hæresis est maximum." So the heresy is the biggest if you doubt the fact that it happened. You couldn't defend yourself in the medievals. The fact that there was a devil, that there were witches and so forth, and that they did witchcraft was a self-evident fact. And that is exactly the same that we have today. It's all declared self-evident. The prosecution is not doesn't need to prove anything. It's all obvious, and the defense is not allowed to challenge anything. Ideology, I would not necessarily say it's ideological. It is fanatical belief in that they face an absolute evil. Back in the medievals, it was the devil incarnate, and the witches at their helpers. And today, the devil incarnate is Adolf Hitler with his gas chambers, and his helpers are the Nazis and neo-Nazis who want to revive it or whitewash it or whatever. This is the picture that is an absolute equivalent to the medieval picture of the devil and the witches, and this you have the very same dynamics. They are, it's a perfect equivalence. Now, back then, of course, witches and the devil, that was all completely invented. Whereas when we're talking about Nazi atrocities during the Second World War, they are not completely invented. They have been distorted, exaggerated, and this and that. But there is a factual difference there. But when it comes to the fanatical blindness of the Inquisition, the parallel is almost perfect.
Well, this is the follow-up question that we'll work in before this break, before we move this interview forward. And what a fantastic interview it has been so far. This is a treat to have Gurmar Rudolph on. It really is, because again, a man who has paid this price and a price that others are now paying for what? That's what we'll get into in just a moment. But this is also on your website, Gurmar, with again regarding the book "Resistance Is Obligatory," GurmarRudolph.com. It is written there that, and I'm quoting straight from your website, that Jews suffered during the Third Reich is not in question, but the notion of a premeditated, planned, and industrial extermination of Europe's Jews with its iconic gas chambers and immutable 6 million are all used to make the Holocaust not only special, but also sacred. And this gets back to the religious nature of it all that we were just talking about. We are faced now with a new secular religion with astonishing power to command worship. Please continue your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, the parallel nature of the witch trials, that the witch trials were religious in nature, and when we're talking about what has replaced the sacred beliefs of 200-300 years ago, you couldn't deny the virginity of Mary, you couldn't deny the divineness of Jesus and so forth, and the Holy Church and blah blah. You could end up on the stake 500, 600 years ago, and today, well, we don't end up on the stake. But if we doubt or deny certain things or challenge certain views on these issues, then reactions are similar, and you could even make parallels. There are saints, there are Pharisees, there are prophets, they are holy sites, they are pilgrimages going to Auschwitz, to Dachau, to all the other camps. The parallel nature of the religions of yore, with the holy relics even that we have today. You go into a museum, you find shoes, you find luggage, you find glasses. They were deposited allegedly of victims. They are venerated. They are treated like holy
I've
relics.
been. I've
So,
seen it. I've been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. This is the truth.
right. And the reaction of people to that, if you violate the beliefs nowadays, nobody gets upset anymore if you deny the divinity of Jesus or the virginity of Mary at birth. Quite to the contrary, more people may laugh at you if you insist on the truth of all these things. However, if you go out there to the average person and says, I don't believe in the gas chambers, the homicidal gas chamber of the Third Reich, that's when you get the treatment that Christian heretics were getting 500 years ago. Safe the stake, fortunately. So I'd rather go in a prison nowadays for several years than having to go through the treatment that they got in the medievals. So we're better off than 500 years ago.
Better off, but it's still quite unjust. And this, and listen, I'm fully aware. All right, folks, there's after 20 years on the radio, all of my naivete has long since been zapped. And so, yes, they'll call me a Holocaust denier for having Grandma Rudolph on. But I mean, they've called me that for years anyway. And in point of fact, we've never even really addressed this issue. We had Pat Buchanan on the show to talk about his excellent book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. And I believe Mark Weber's been on to respond to the Buchanan interview about that. But other than that, we haven't really touched Germany World War history, even though I'm, called a neo-Nazi and a white supremacist and a Holocaust denier. So that's fine. I mean, they call me the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Anything goes. I don't worry about any of that. What I do worry about is innocent people going to prison for having a difference of opinion. And this is the thing we always say. I mean, this is one of our taglines here. They love diversity. They really do. Give back to the religious connotations. They worship at the this cult worships at the altar of diversity, but they certainly have zero tolerance, and they always say we're the intolerant ones, but they have zero tolerance for the diversity of opinion. Germar, we have just seconds remaining before the break, but well, I was going to ask you, how the word denier has become such a pejorative. Denier, COVID denier, Holocaust denier. What is it about the word denier that seems to have so much power, or that they think has so much power? And just a few seconds on that.
I think first of all, it's completely misplaced. Holocaust denier makes no sense. There is no such thing as the Holocaust. A thing, a monolithic one topic that you can't deny. The Holocaust is an umbrella term that covers so much of what even mainstream historians, some of it, say it didn't take place. That was an exaggeration. Okay, that was invented. We were wrong there. There have been revisions even for the mainstream. So, what exactly are you talking about when you're saying denying? You're denying this, you're denying that. This just makes no sense. And that is probably true for other topics too. You make an umbrella sweeping statement, you deny something completely when, in
Quick.
fact, you may only be challenging aspects of it. So,
Let's take a quick break.
it's meant to
Meant to stifle and suppress, undoubtedly, the rigorous debate of true diversity of opinion. We'll be right back with Germar Rudolph. Stay tuned.
Protecting your liberties. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA News, I'm Laura Winters.
Shake, rattle, and roll. Aftershocks still being felt after that rare 4.8 magnitude earthquake hitting the Northeast, the epicenter in the town of Lebanon, New Jersey, that's about 50 miles away from New York City. For a period of time on Friday, ground stops at the New York area airports, including Newark, New Jersey, LaGuardia, and JFK, as runways were inspected for cracks, more than 600 flights delayed, more than 30 canceled. Dave Collins has more.
You cannot plan for this. There's no early warnings. There's no weather service that can tell you an earthquake is imminent.
The U.S. Geological Survey confirms a 4.8 magnitude earthquake occurred with the epicenter in Lebanon, New Jersey. Social media posts started popping up from folks feeling the shake from New York City to Long Island, upstate New York, New Jersey, and Philadelphia. I'm Dave Collins.
A historic event taking place on Monday, but now the possibility of cloud cover remains a concern along the path of totality for Monday's total solar eclipse. USA's John Schaefer says Mother Nature may mess up your viewing. Here's his report.
According to the latest information from the National Weather Service, individuals from Texas through Arkansas and potentially in Ohio, northwestern Pennsylvania, and western New York may experience obstacles in viewing the eclipse. Northern New England and the region stretching from southern Missouri to central Indiana have been identified as areas with the most favorable conditions for clear viewing.
Turning now to sports, the Final Four semifinal games tonight in Glendale, Arizona. First up, the game between Purdue and NC State at 6:09 Eastern, and then number one UConn and number four Alabama play at 8:49 p.m. Monday night is the national championship game starting at 9:20 Eastern. And I'm Laura Winters, USA News.
I'd like to introduce you to our new sponsor, Get the Tea. Get the Tea carries all natural, non-GMO organic teas and supplements made in the USA. Get the Tea's ingredients are the purest available. My favorite is Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea is a gentle daily cleanse containing 12 herbs that when combined really keep things moving. I drink it every day and my energy has never been better. I'm feeling great. Life Change Tea comes in three delicious flavors, natural, peppermint, and pomegranate. It's an easy and delicious way to keep your digestion on track. And for those on the go, try D365. D365 is Life Change Tea in a capsule. Drink the tea or take D365 capsules and keep your digestion running smoothly. Go to GetTheTea.com and enter discount code USA to get 10% off any size order. That's GetTheTea.com, discount code USA for 10% off your order.
Hello, TPC family. It's James, and I've got to tell you that I sleep better at night knowing that there are organizations like the Conservative Citizens Foundation. The purpose of the Conservative Citizens Foundation is to promote the principles of limited government, individual liberty, equality before the law, property rights, law and order, judicial restraint, and states' rights, while at the same time exploring the dangers posed by liberalism to our national interests and cultural institutions. The Conservative Citizens Foundation also seeks to educate the public on the dangers of extremist ideologies like critical race theory and cultural Marxism. I've worked with the good people at the Conservative Citizens Foundation for many years, and their work comes with my complete endorsement. For more information and to keep up with all the latest conservative news headlines, please check out their website, AmericaFirst.com. That's MERICA1ST.com, AmericaFirst.com. Hey friends, James Edwards here again to remind you that Antelope Hill Publishing is America's premier provider of dissident literature. They print books that mainstream publishers are too afraid to touch, providing you with information you need to challenge the status quo. Whether your interest includes contemporary dissident politics, history that would otherwise be censored or slandered, philosophy, or exciting and thought-provoking fiction, you'll find plenty to love in the Antelope Hill catalog, which includes books such as Generation 68, The Elite Revolution and Its Legacy, about the elite-driven cultural revolution of the 1960s, which transformed America. Whitey on the Moon, about the demise of the space program due to diversity. The Sword of Christ, which argues for restoring Christianity as the foundation of the West and combating heresies like Christian Zionism. Speeches by Mussolini and other historical figures, and much more. With new titles added every month, there's no doubt that they have something for everyone. So check out their catalog today at AntelopeHillPublishing.com. engrossing conversation with Germar Rudolph, one of the men who has paid a price. 44 months in prison is what he was sentenced to for questioning the official narrative about World War II. Now, let me just say this, a little bit more information about Germar. As you know, he endured severe measures of persecution. He went into exile in the UK, where he started a small revisionist outlet, Castle Hill Publishers. When Germany asked Britain to extradite Rudolph in 1999, he fled to the United States. Here, he applied for political asylum, expanded his publishing activities, and in 2004 married a U.S. citizen. I actually met Germar in 2004. In 2005, the U.S. recognized his marriage as valid and then immediately thereafter arrested and subsequently deported him back to Germany, where he was put in prison for 44 months. That's what we're talking about. If you're asking, you know, what's going on now, he is back in the United States now, rejoined with his citizen wife and daughter. He currently resides in Texas. So that is where he is, and that is the rest of the story, as they say, about that. Now, with regard to the topic of the first half hour, I don't care if you believe that 6 million Jews died or maybe it was 4 million. I guess that would get you put into prison, right, Germar? If you said it was just 4 million, 200,000 or...
On the context. It depends on the context. If you're a Jewish scholar who otherwise subscribes to the mainstream narrative, you can fiddle with the numbers a little bit more liberally than if you're a non-Jewish scholar who has maybe dissident views on other topics as well. So there's always leeway.
All right, so there are exceptions, but nevertheless, whatever you believe, maybe you say, well, hey, you know, the United States put Japanese citizens in concentration camps. Yes, there were camps. A lot of people died. What do you think was going on in Germany in 1945? They had no supplies. They had no rail. You couldn't get food. You couldn't get medicine. A lot of people died of diseases in those camps. There's no doubt about that. All right, but I don't want to engage in a cheap game of whataboutism, but I think it's an important question. You know, the Holodomor, all right, for instance. Whatever you think happened in Germany, whatever you believe, if you believe it all, it wouldn't be unique, really, in terms of so-called genocides. There's a lot of genocides that have happened, real genocides. The Holodomor, also known as the Ukrainian famine, that was a man-made, socially engineered famine, as you know, in the Soviet Ukraine, that killed millions of Ukrainians. And Holodomor, when literally translated from Ukrainian, means death by hunger. And the sacred victims of World War II Germany were the ones perpetrating this, for God's sake. How about the Cambodian genocide by the Khmer Rouge? 25% of Cambodia's population was wiped out, 1.5 to 2 million people. In the Holodomor, 3 to 5 million, they say. It was probably more than that. So what I'm saying is, Germar, other atrocities have taken place during wartime and even out of wartime, but I don't know of any other one that you go to prison for questioning. Why is that?
The political importance of upholding this narrative for the upkeep of the current pecking order in the world of the post-war political order, the narrative of unique German guilt, unique German evilness is required to say it was a just war, pure war against pure evil. And all the things that were done are justified, and the way we live in today's world is perfectly all right. There are many more motives that are interested in upholding this and pushing this. You have Jewish motives, you have motives of the former Allied victorious powers, you have any kind of left-wing or internationalist movement that has an interest in suppressing anything, any identity movement, wherever it is, that is against leftist ideology, against international globalist ideas. And the Holocaust is a perfect tool to accomplish all this in one fell swoop. And that's why so many powers, so many interest groups have an interest in putting this out there as the ultimate dogma that you have to believe in, because it just supports their cause and the current power structure that we have in the world. Now
All
it's
right,
then,
let's.
of course, also a kind of a revolutionary act going against it. And I didn't know it when I started what I was shaking at there, the boat I was rocking. I found out the hard way and learned more and more that this isn't just a small subsection of German history. It has a huge repercussion on our world, political and societal world order.
Well, it's definitely been used as a bludgeon for white guilt. I mean, if I could get on and say this right now, you know, hey, I don't believe anybody starved to death during the Hall of Manure. I don't think the Bolsheviks really killed anybody. I'm not going to go to jail for that. But I mean, there's nothing, you know, for them to gain from that. You know, there is something to be gained. There is real political and financial power in having this bludgeon, which they wield quite bluntly. Again, over the course of the last month, Garmar, on this program, we had Keith Woods on from Ireland. We had, as I mentioned, Van Langenhove on in Belgium. He is facing his own year in prison. It's on appeal right now, but he's, I don't want to say this, but I guess most likely going to prison for not reprimanding someone in a group chat for saying something that offended the sensibilities, the delicate sensibilities of so-called minorities. Depending on how you look at it, I guess, the fight to preserve free speech and expression is either going worse than ever before or better than it has in years. On one hand, you have the particularly absurd recent prison sentences given to Melia and Van Langenhove, respectively, in the UK and in Belgium, as you know, we continue to mention. But on the other hand, even with censorship and deplatforming still ubiquitous on social media and elsewhere in the general public, the internet has gone a long way in leveling the playing field to an extent where our ideas have become much more ascendant in recent years, the last 3 to 5 years especially. With regard to current trends and what's going on in Europe right now, are you a glass is half full type of guy, having been there yourself 44 months, or a glass is half empty kind of guy with regards to our current prospects?
The powers that be want to empty it, and they are draining it. The internet has been a free platform in the when it was first invented in the mid and early 1990s, and I have seen more and more censorship. I've seen censorship by governments who clamp down. When we're talking about shows like we do here in the United States, the platforms that allow them, many European IP providers have to block them, or even platforms, YouTube censors and Vimeo censors videos, and all these platforms do. BitChute does a lot of stuff in the US, but they have to block it in Europe. That was different in the 1990s. There was no censorship on the internet. You had complete freedom. So I am seeing more and more censorship clamping down on the internet that is getting more and more restricted. And when it comes to the law, what we see in Europe is a harmonization of European law according to a standard that was set by the European Parliament in 2007, recommending or kind of coaxing all membership states to implement anti-hate speech legislation. And that's what we have been seeing. I've actually developed a map that goes year by year, turning red, a country that has implemented laws against free speech. Against peaceful free speech, and the map has gone redder and redder every year, and there are few countries left standing. It's mainly the Scandinavian country, Ireland, and some minor countries on the Balkans that are still completely free of these things, but the rest of Europe is pretty much caught up in it. And if you look at actually who has been pushing this agenda in the European Parliament, the European Commission, it's been the German government. The German government has been at the forefront of it, and they haven't encountered much resistance, I must say. The French have been pushing along with that, too. They were on that train pretty early, too. And when the Germans and the French gang up against the rest of Europe, then you can bet on that everyone else will follow, and they have been following. And as I mentioned, there's not much resistance, except for minority groups like you and me represent, maybe. And unfortunately, that's what's going on. So the glass is, or the cup's getting drained dry.
You know, I...
I'm not sanguine that it's going to improve anytime soon. It's going to get worse because of the immigration situation getting worse, necessarily getting worse. Europe, the ethnic European populations in every single country are undergoing demographic collapse. And immigration, mass immigration, is a naturally inevitable consequence of it because nature does not allow a vacuum. European ethnic populations are dying out. Germany at the forefront. They have a reproductive rate of only a third per generation. So there is tensions coming that require, quote unquote, for those in power who want this smooth replacement of the ethnic European populations by mass immigration from mainly Africa and Asia, to be done without the ethnic European population putting up a fight and doing any resistance. And that's what you're seeing. That is not new in history. As a matter of fact, if I may go back in history, in the middle 18th century, we had one of the first censorship laws in Europe, quelling dissent of the population against mass immigration. There was Prussia. Frederick the Great was facing the challenge that his country, mainly the Brandenburg area, had been depopulated during the 30-year war some 100 years earlier, and he tried to repopulate it, get all those empty villages repopulated with people, and he invited dissidents from France that were persecuted by the French, the Huguenots and others. And so Prussia in that time was flooded with French immigrants, but also from other European countries, and the population didn't like it, so they were speaking out. They were making propaganda against this immigration, like right-wing groups nowadays in Europe do. And Frederick didn't have any of it. He implemented the first European censorship law in the book against incitement to hatred against immigrants, and as it's been with Germany ever since. And it has been transformed this way and that, but that's the core where it all started, and that's where we are again today. Of course, back then it was just inter-European migration, which is not that big of a deal. You know, I'd love to have French people come to my neighborhood. I have nothing to oppose against that. Now we are talking global migration and complete replacement of ethnic populations. This is bound to cause much bigger problems, and this is what they are preparing for, to make sure that nobody puts their head above the parapet.
This is, Germar, first of all, let me say, my friend, how much I've enjoyed this hour. I'm entirely enthralled by this conversation. I only wish we could extend it for the rest of the program. We will have you back. But I want to say this. You talked about a lot in that last little bit. And talking about the... Well, as Buchanan put it, the death of the West, the death of Europe, our birth rates are plummeting, coupled with mass immigration, the Great Replacement. That is a twofer that is going to wipe out and extinguish, potentially, if trends are not reversed, it will extinguish the light of the world, which is what our people have been. I was in Germany in 2005, and I was in this picturesque little town on the Rhine. It was the same town where Martin Luther was tried. And I was in a bar. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That was the name of it. And I was in a bar one night, and I was in line. And it just so happened that of all the little bars in this little town, two people in front of me, it was an older couple, but they were from America. And they were going up to the bartender, and he was a very strapping, you know, German young man, you know, in his 20s, which is what I was at that time, too. And he just looked like the prototype, you know what I'm talking about. And they got to talking with him, said, "Oh, you're from America." And they, "Yes, yes, yes." And they said, "Yes, we were here, and we've been touring Germany, and we went to Auschwitz." And he instantly just went into this, "Oh, it's so great that you went there, because I think it's so important that people from America know how evil, you know, Germany was during those years." And he just went on and on and on about it. And there was something that just struck me in that moment about it, how just incredibly sad that was. I own it all. I own the history of our people. brothers and cousins throughout Europe, the good, the bad, the indifferent, whatever it is, I own it all, and I feel zero guilt about any of it, because for whatever our faults, we have done more good for all of humanity, all of the races of the world, than any other people group have done, and never any gratitude, only the grievances. So all of this, you know, I saw that, and I'm like, you know, if you lose your confidence, Germar, if you lose the confidence in your people and in your culture and in your history, you are dead, and that is another reason why Europe is dying, and that is one thing we have got to do. We have got to turn that around. There is so much to be proud about, so much more to be proud about than anything there is to regret or have remorse over. And then you see this thing in Scotland. You know, we're talking about hate crimes, so-called hate crimes. Scotland, just this week, has passed this new law where if you stir up hate, this is what they call stirring up hate, and it includes, you know, transgender propaganda, where if you misgender, you know, and then what that means is, folks, you know what that means. If it's a guy pretending to be a female or vice versa, and you call them by their biological sex, you can go to prison. Now, J.K. Rowling, who's no conservative, but she wrote the Harry Potter series, she's saying, well, just put me in prison. You know, I'm not going to play along with this. And I think within the first couple of hours, Germar, of this becoming a law, the police had over 4,000 telephone calls from people who believe that they know somebody who has violated this law by misgendering them, and go get them and arrest them and put them in prison like they did you for calling, as my co-host would say, a spade a dirty shovel, but for, you know, calling them what they are, male or female. There's two genders. What are we talking about here? I guess the question is now, will there ever be a point, in your opinion, at which the absurdity of these hate crime laws will become their own undoing? Can we ever reach that point? Serious question.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, looking at German history, the history of Germany has a sad history of censorship and suppression of freedom of opinion. And the Second World War was supposedly fought to stop the quote-unquote German violation of everyone else's civil right. But the German people was the first to lose their civil rights. They needed liberation, yes, to some degree, but they didn't get it. Censorship just changed its name, and it's still around, and it's getting worse. I don't know what it takes, whether it takes a complete collapse of everything, a major paradigm shift worldwide, because it's not just Europe. Face it, Australia and Canada. Canada is just about to implement a law that's even more ridiculous. They have a Orwellian speech they call peace bond, what the Nazis called protective custody, to put someone in prison who they think might in the future commit a hate speech crime.
That's right.
And because he's known as having a loose mouth, and therefore we put him preventively into custody up to 1 year without him having committed anything, because he hasn't done anything. He's not going to get a trial because there's nothing to try. We just lock him away for society's safety reason. And this is what the Nazis called Schutzhaft. This is how the concentration camps came about. And this is the track Canada is on, and the rest of Europe is not yet on. But like with everything else, it doesn't matter whether you like the opinion of a person who gets in trouble. There's people in the resistance in Germany during the Third Reich said, well, first they come for the communists, and I don't care for the communists because I'm not a communist. Then come for the Jews, and I don't care for the Jews because I'm not a Jew. Then they come for the socialists, and I don't care, I'm not a socialist, do them. And then they come for the liberals, and I'm still not concerned. And then they come for the conservatives, and, well, that's me, and now there's nobody left to help me. And this is the kind of situation where a society has to get to for people to realize en masse that what's going on is just wrong, that there needs to be a general resistance where people need to go out in the street and violate unjust law purposefully, like J.K. Rowling has done. We need not just one person, we need millions on the road who demonstrate and commit in public that what is illegal, because the justice system can impossibly prosecute thousands, 10,000, hundreds of thousands of people. This is what it takes. And I think the million people who disagree with it are out there. It's just a matter of connecting, of creating an awareness, of making everyone aware that if we act together, if we all stand up and say enough is enough, that is too much for a government, for the authorities to bear, they can't handle it. If they can take us out, One by one, they win. If we stand up mutually all together, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of us, the game is over. And that's what it takes.
Well, and you've seen a little bit of that. I mean, you've seen the farmers in Europe. You've seen the truckers in Canada. And we had, I mean, just last month, yes, we talked with, yeah, what Canada's trying to do is going to make Germany look like a bastion of free speech if that gets passed. We had Paul Fromm on the show last month, Remy Tremblay. Also from Germany, I got to ask you this, and I want to remind everybody, germarrudolph.com to learn more about this man, his books, his work, his ideas, GermarRudolph, germarrudolph.com. Rapidly running out of time, but another guest we had on live from Bavaria last month was Sascha Rossmuller, who you may be familiar with, and he was talking about the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland Party, and his party, the Homeland. Now, both of these parties are described. There is resistance out there. This is what I'm saying. And everybody we had on during the month of March were international.
I disagree. The AfD is the one party that has ratted me out to the police, got me in legal trouble, and made me, the German authorities deny me a passport. Now, the AfD is false flag. They are handing in any dissident more quickly than the other ones because they think they have to prove that they're not evil right-wingers.
All right,
so
hold on.
I've had it with this party.
No. Just very quickly, just a point of clarification. He said that as well. He said this is a resistance, a false resistance. People are voting for them because they think they may be that, so on and so forth. What I'm saying is the resistance is people like Sascha, all right? People like Paul Fromm, Nick Griffin, a lot of people we had on last month. There is a resistance out there. But you actually answered my question. But the question was, both of these parties are described as neo-Nazi parties. Of course, you know, we're all called that, so it doesn't take much to earn that label. But I was going to ask you your opinion of the parties. I wasn't saying those parties, or especially the AfD, was the resistance, but there are good people out there in Europe, like Sascha, like the people we featured last month. But you pretty much just answered. Are there any parties in Europe? I mean, you have Vlaams Belang. I mean, you know, there are some parties out there that seem to be doing good things. Are there any parties out there, any organized resistance in Europe that you see above and beyond individuals?
It's illegal. We've tried to form a free speech organization that it goes against the laws and tries to lobby against those anti-free speech laws. And these are considered criminal organizations because they try to legalize what's illegal. And these criminal organizations, free speech lobby organizations in Europe, at the points where it really matters, are considered criminal organizations and they get banned.
Yeah. Even parties, even like Golden Dawn in Greece, even parties who get, this is what Nick Griffin said last month, parties get close to power, they get banned. They you know, if there is legitimate resistance going on. But there, as you said, though, Germar, there are still millions of people who believe. It's just a matter of how do we get everyone pulling in the right direction? Well, certainly that's the age-old question.
This is,
and if we knew the answer.
Like in any dictatorship, because that's what we have here, dictating people. There's no contradiction between democracy and dictatorship. Let me make that clear to the listeners. Democracy is when two wolves and a sheep decide what's for dinner. That is democracy. If you don't put in the rule of law that safeguards fundamental human and civil rights, then democracy is lynch mob. And that's what we're seeing here, where civil rights are not guaranteed. The lynch mob of the majority is starting to lynch the minority. That's what we're seeing here. And therefore, we have facing a dictatorship that dictates what we are allowed to say or not. That's the very definition of a dictatorship. And in a dictatorship, you have to organize underground, Samizdat, catacomb style. That is what has to be done. You can't be official in these kind of circumstances.
I was going to ask you what other issues and projects you're currently working on. We will save that question because we are out of time. We'll save that question for the next time. And I can't wait for the next time because I really enjoyed this time. In the meantime, germarrudolph.com. Folks, there are good people out there and by the millions. And we try to feature as many of them as we can on this program. Hope springs. So long as we breathe, we hope. There's an old Latin phrase. It's the motto of South Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. So long as we breathe, we hope. But Gurmar, thank you for setting an example. Thank you for being strong. And thank you for your time tonight. We will talk to you again soon. Let's talk off the air. Let's collaborate. We'll be right back. Stay tuned, everybody.